And welcome to Family Meal here with Chef Mark Conway on, let's see, you probably hear this show on any number of different platforms, from your favorite podcast site after the show goes live on Spoonie Radio, which is a food radio station on iHeartRadio, all the way through iTunes and Google Play, and one of my favorites is Radio Public, because you can download the Radio Public app regardless of what type of phone you have. So if you're trying to figure out a really good way to get your podcast, Radio Public's one to give a try to. But today, we have, again, another fantastic guest. And it's one of the guests' companies that I met while I was at the National Restaurant Association show in Chicago. Again, I challenge you, if you like food, if you're in the food industry, in the beverage industry, and anything that relates to people eating or drinking, and you have not been to the National Restaurant Association show in Chicago, you should go. It's important, and this very show is because of a trip to Chicago to go to that show. So as you're walking around the National Restaurant Association, it's like watching a city unfold. You have different wings, different buildings, different setups, and they're all huge. You could not walk the entire show in an hour. It will take you so much. It'll take you all day. And you may only make one building doing that. Hundreds and hundreds of vendors. But just like anything, when you go to something like that, there's certain companies that stand out. Today's guest is the man in charge, the CEO of one of those companies. And I got to tell you, of all the things I tried when I was there, there's a handful that just blew me away. Because they're good, like really good. Not like, okay, I've seen a dozen of these, 24, whatever. This is one of those you walk away and months later, you still remember the product. And we are talking to Justin Stiefel of Heritage Distilling Company. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate being on the show.
Absolutely. Man, I was excited. I had you on the list the whole time, ever since leaving NRA, because, and we were talking before we went on air, I was just floored by not only how good your product is, and I can't see enough praises for that, but I was floored by your people, because, you go to a lot of these shows, and you see a lot of rented help in the booths, and they're there just to hand out samples and smile. Everybody I met at your booth was not only absolutely invested in this brown sugar bourbon, but literally enjoyed being there. They were laughing. They were talking. They supported each other. When you walked up, they never let you feel like just somebody who pulled a number at a deli counter. It was great. Well, the conversations we had.
That's good to hear. We like to say we're slow to hire and quick to fire. We really try to find amazing people and then get out of the way and let them do what they're good at. And so at the NRA show this year, what you saw were some of our team members who are in charge of our event planning and the execution of that, but also some of our national salespeople. And it's because that show in particular, the NRA show, is where 60% of the people who attend that show only go to that show. And those people who attend that show by and large are buyers and chefs and kitchen planners and owners of some of the smallest single mom and pop local restaurants and bars, all the way up to some of the biggest players on the planet, including major cruise lines and airlines and national restaurant chains and everything in between. And so when you show up, you got to show up big. And that is the preeminent show to get in front of the people who we think are going to be most successful in using our product and introducing it to folks in bars and restaurants. And we were thrilled with the feedback. I mean, I didn't attend this year, but what the team reported back to me, I was very proud of what they did. High energy, passion. When you have passion for something, it's easy for you to pass it on, to spread it to other folks. It becomes infectious. And I'm thrilled that you felt that same excitement that we feel every day making these products and bringing them to people.
So you mentioned passion, you know, and that is a term that, especially in the restaurant industry, it gets thrown around a lot. You know, everybody loves to ask chefs, why did you get into this? Oh, it's the passion. It's the passion. But I think when you really break it down and you get past the word, there's substance behind it. And your line of products, and when I was there, I got to try the brown sugar bourbon. And honestly, for me, I am not typically a brown liquor person. I usually stay towards the vodkas. You know, it's just, I like them. I like, as a cocktail, I usually steer towards the vodka drinks. But that brown sugar bourbon was, and again, you know, just like passion, the word smooth gets thrown around. To me, it was such a clean flavor. And you actually got those notes of brown sugar.
Well, it's funny because it's actually brown sugar that goes into it. You know, we don't use any artificial stuff. I actually like to dissect words because words have meaning, and people use words for different reasons. It's part of the language that's developed over the course of hundreds and thousands of years. You look at the word passion, and if you break it down to three root words, it's just missing a letter T in the middle, because really what passion breaks down into is pass it on. So if you are really passionate about something, if you really feel in your gut, your core level, strongly about something, you want to share it and you want to pass it on. And so that's what passion is about. It's about being so excited, so invested in something that you want to share it with the world. And that's how people know, because they are on the receiving end of that kind of energy and excitement when you demonstrate that passion. So when it comes to this product in particular, BSB, we call it BSB, brown sugar bourbon. We looked at the landscape and looked at all the flavored whiskeys that are out there. We had requests from lots of customers to make different kinds of flavored whiskeys. The flavored whiskey market is growing about 10% a year. So it's one of the fastest growing segments in the spirits space. We looked at the flavor options that were out there and we decided we wanted to go all natural. And when you taste this product, you should be tasting three things. You should be tasting brown sugar, a little bit of cinnamon, and you should be tasting bourbon. And your comment about you gravitating more towards vodkas and less to bourbons historically, we find that this is a tremendous gateway product for people who have not yet found their way to enjoy bourbon and brown spirits. And I joke around with our staff. I say, look, in 10 years, 8 to 10 years, I expect to get Christmas cards from all the big, old, traditional bourbon companies in Kentucky thanking us for introducing 2 or 5 or 10 million new bourbon drinkers into the space because they started with BSB as a way to kind of move into that. And as you get older, as you know, Chef, your palate changes.
Oh, yeah.
You begin to, your taste buds change. You begin to develop the ability to discern deeper notes, more complex notes. And so it becomes a natural gravitation to move in your younger years from really cheap light beer or wine coolers into maybe some wines. And then when you get a little older, you begin to really appreciate some of the really beautiful, deep, dark, rich red wines and some of the very nuanced white wines. Similar with spirits. You know, vodka traditionally has been flavorless and tasteless. And it's ideal for mixing lots of things in because it's like a white palette that a painter would use. Bourbon and rye whiskey and single malt, they all have complex notes based on how they're made, how they're aged, and so on. So, we think that the BSB is a tremendous opportunity for us to get our company and our brand in front of a lot of people who otherwise would not be enjoying brown spirits, and a way to just kind of allow people to awaken their appreciation for a whole new type of product to enjoy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it definitely taught mentioning and comparing as a gateway brown spirit is dead on point. And it's funny because brown sugar is an incredibly known commodity. It's very popular in every facet of cooking. You'll see from the barbecue guys doing brown sugar rubs all the way to brown sugar crusted steaks at steakhouses to, in deep southern cooking, the brown sugar sweet potatoes. it's a great thing for people to understand when they're going to try something new. And that's why so many great recipes start off with a known paired with an unknown. Because it takes a fear factor away. And that brown sugar bourbon is, you get all of those notes. You definitely get brown sugar. You get the cinnamon, but it's not that, you know, and a lot of people throw around cinnamon, but they get that red hot sensation, like that old candy.
Yeah.
You get actual cinnamon. That's what I got out of it, was the actual cinnamon.
Well, look, we fundamentally believe that what should go in the bottle is stuff that you should be able to go out and harvest naturally. I keep trying to plant for my daughter who's 10. She loves cotton candy. I keep trying to plant the cotton candy tree in my backyard and it will not grow. It dies every time I plant it. But brown sugar it's the first most valuable element that comes from sugarcane. A lot of people, you know, we've lost this kind of agrarian, historical viewpoint because of just the way things are processed and packaged these days. You know, most of the white sugar that you see at the store is not from sugarcane these days. It comes from an amalgamated, sugar beet process. Brown sugar is the best, purest, highest form of celebrating sugarcane. And I tell my friends in the rum industry, we take the best parts of the sugar cane for brown sugar bourbon, and we give you all the scraps. And with the scraps, you go make rum. and then we're gonna take, because rum is made from the byproduct of processing sugar cane, either cane juice, molasses, or actual sugar. I've not yet found a single person who hates brown sugar.
Nope.
As a thing, right?
They haven't seen
I've
one.
Not yet found one. Right. Yeah. And to your point, it works in everything, all elements of cooking.
It really does. Now, so I could go on and on for days about all the nuances I love, and we're going to dive more into each one because you've got a beautiful line of products. But what prompted you to one day to say, I want to have a distilling company?
Huh. Well, I was 6 years old. It goes back to being six, and when the household I grew up in, we didn't have cable TV. We had three or four over-the-air channels. This is in the 80s, late 70s. And in reruns was the TV show called MASH. You remember?
Yep.
With Alan Alda. And so I remember being 6 years old and asking my dad, what are they doing in that tent? They've got this apparatus, this thing, and it had glass tubes and coils, and it was bubbling. They had a Bunsen burner, and they had at the time I didn't know, but it was a martini glass, and this liquid went in, they shook it up, and they threw an olive or an onion in, and then they would drink it. And I was asking my dad, what is that? And he said, oh, that's a distill. They're distilling grain into alcohol. And I was fascinated by that. And so in seventh grade, I made a still in a chemistry class, and I got an A for the project.
Nice.
And I've just always been fascinated with processes. I'm really kind of a process-driven guy. So in college, I studied chemical engineering. I then went to work in the United States Senate in Washington, D.C., worked on oil and gas policy, and went to law school while I was there. And from the West Coast originally, and my wife and I, we were there in D.C. 13 years with three kids, and we just were tired and everything and wanted to get back home. So we moved back home to Washington State in 2010. And the year prior, the legislature had made distilling legal for the first time since Prohibition. In Washington State, we have a rich history of alcohol production, adult beverage production, going back to the 50s when winemakers began to really plant wines that would eventually rival the wines grown in France and the grapes and the wines produced in France and California. To the point now where Washington has almost 1,000 wineries, second largest wine producer behind only California in the U.S. We have now 500 breweries in Washington. In Oregon, there's another 300 or so breweries. The Pacific Northwest is really focused on local, local ingredients, supporting local businesses and an entrepreneurial spirit. And in the area I live about an hour out of Seattle. You know, we've got some of the world's biggest companies that have changed the world, the landscape of the world, literally starting with Boeing, then going to Microsoft, than going to Amazon. All these companies change the landscape for every consumer on the planet in different ways. And we grow almost everything we need here in Washington State to make amazing beer, wine, and spirits. We've got huge apple production. People think Idaho is the biggest potato growing state. That's not true. Grant County, Washington grows more potatoes than the entire state of Idaho on an annual basis. We have huge peach and cherry and apricot oysters. I was thinking of fish and oysters, farms, where they're growing all these crops, corn, white wheat, red wheat, rye grain. We have everything we need, with the exception of sugarcane and agave. So those are the two things that we, you know, can't really source locally. So we're sitting around a campfire, much like you sit around the table with your family. I was sitting around the campfire in May of 2011 with some friends and family. We were drinking some scotch and smoking cigars. And I said, you know, the law changed a couple years ago. I have an idea. I think we can do some really interesting things. The next morning, when we woke up and kind of the previous night's activities wore off, we sat down with a cup of coffee with a couple of friends and kind of walked through the idea again. It still sounded like a good idea. And here we are now, 8 years later. We have six distilleries up and running, six tasting rooms, two more big ones under construction, a couple of really interesting partnerships that we'll be unveiling in the spring of next year on some big initiatives we're working on. We have 178 employees. We produce a full line of products, gin, flavored whiskey. We integrate the customer into the experience. When you walk into one of our tasting rooms, the first thing we want you to be is visually intoxicated. We use that term specifically, visual intoxication. We want you to walk in, see some amazing stuff, see our products, see our barrels, see our copper and our stainless steel, and then approach our employees and ask them what's going on. And that allows us the opportunity to educate them and to convert them and to show them that craft spirits can be amazing. You know, 15 years ago, if you walked into any bar in America, walked up to the bartender and said, I want the thickest, haziest, hoppiest pale ale you can give me, they would have laughed you out of the bar. Yep. Because all of the beer taps would have been huge domestic brands that we all know today. And now, if you walk into any respectable operation, 80% of those tap handles are going to be local or regional craft brands of beer, of the most interesting varieties you could find.
Absolutely.
A couple big domestics, right? You're going to find some tremendous wines, regionally grown and produced. And now you're going to find, ideally, craft spirits from your own backyard, your own region, being featured on cocktail menus and in the back bar and at the local retailers. So distilling is about 15, 20 years behind the growth curve of breweries. And we're really 50 years behind where wineries started to really kind of cement themselves in the culture.
But you're seeing, and that's the thing is, you know, over the past 20, 15, 10, 5 years, food media, and when I say food media, it's food and beverage, has grown so much. And that's had such an impact following exactly the path you're talking about. When it comes to, you know, the consumer, the person that comes in, the customer, the guest that walks into any establishment is so much more particular on flavor, on quality, on local, because this food and beverage media juggernaut that has come along has, you know, and for better or for worse, you'll hear a lot of things about Food Network. For better or for worse, they grew off of the PBS that I watched as a kid. And I watched tons of PBS as a kid on all the food channels. But what was interesting is you're seeing that now. People, yes, breweries have lit off. Like in my area here in Eastern Virginia, it just seems like another brewery is opening every other week. But it just goes to show you, to your point, if you're going to a good establishment, a good restaurant, a good whatever it is, you're not going to see all of those big, you know, national chain beers and everything else on there. you're going to see they're going to have a selection of local. I think I went to a little place over here the other day. I think they had 20 different local beers on tap.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
The variety is indicative of what people are wanting these days. From a brewer's perspective, if you have a tap room and you've got 15 or 20 different beers on tap, the customers come through. You got to use that tasting room as an incubator to test products on customers. And if one begins to shine and kind of rise above the rest, then what we do is we would do the same thing. We would take that information, go to our local distributor, go to our regional distributor and say, hey, we think we found the next product that's going to have some real interest. Here's the data. Let's figure out if this makes sense to put into broader distribution. And then, you know, go market it and support the product. On the food side, you see this more than anybody. Pretty easy tests that consumers can do on their own. Doesn't require anything but some time and a little bit of cash. Go to the grocery store, pick up eggs, you know, regular eggs that you would find that are the cheapest, and then find the organic eggs and buy half a dozen or a dozen of each, take them home. Get some of that farmed Atlantic salmon, and then get some wild caught salmon from the West Coast or from Alaska. Get an organic type avocado, and then we'll get just like a randomly typed avocado. Cut all of them open. The egg yolks are such a different color yellow in the mass-produced eggs versus the organic. They are so different in the yellow and the texture. The salmon, farm salmon versus wild-caught salmon, so different in texture and color and flavor. Avocados, I mean, on and on and on. We want to approach the spirits the same way. When you taste our products, you're not going to have a funky flavor that is synthetic, that's trying to approach something. You're going to have the real thing. And then you're not going to have that trail of aspartame or Diet Pepsi type flavor that hits the back of your throat.
Because that's the worst.
Any of those ingredients. To the point where, you know, in the 2000s, you saw these huge displays of flavored vodkas from all the mass-produced vodka companies. Different flavors. Some natural, some not natural, like whipped cream vodka. I mean, I'm sorry, that's not a natural thing.
No, it's not real. It's not real at all.
Not real. Not real. So it defeats the purpose of going and buying peach flavored vodka. If first it doesn't even taste like they held the bottle outside the truck window when they drove by a peach orchard.
Yep.
Okay. To the point where you have to add so much other stuff to your cocktail to mask the flavor because the peach flavor of the vodka is so bad and artificial, it defeats the purpose.
Oh, yeah.
Might as well just use regular vodka and real peach juice or get a really high-quality craft product. So that's the way we try to approach everything, and the response from customers is fantastic.
Yeah, you're definitely onto it, and that's, you know, it's like when I go to the farmers markets. I'm a huge farmers market fan. We have, you know, several here. Whenever I'm anywhere else when I travel, I always want to go to the farmers market, especially if I'm going to be cooking. If I'm going to be demoing or chefing somewhere or cooking, I want to go to the farmer's market because to your point when you talked about, you know, these aspartame-laden cocktails, you know, people should, you know, get afraid of jalapenos. And everybody that knows me knows that's one of my staples that I cook with is jalapenos. And when you go get them from the grocery store, number one, you're going to be lucky if they have any heat and all. You're also going to be lucky if they have any flavor at all. Then if you go to a farm and get a good bushel of jalapenos, they're going to have heat, but more importantly, people don't realize what a fruity flavor a jalapeno actually has. And they've never had one until they've gotten one from a farm. So making products like this, you know, distilling, and for people who have not been to a distillery, and you're going to the breweries, and you're going to the wineries and things like that, I want to tell you, it's, and maybe that's just me, but it's one of the most beautiful places I've been with all of the different copper and all of the stills. It is just, it's an experience, like you said, visually, but the opportunity to sample the differences that go from very, very subtle to very, very strong in a well-educated environment, it's one of my favorite, if it's, if I, it's really easy for me to say the distilleries are my favorite tour above wineries and breweries, because to me, there is as much distinction in flavor and nuance between distilleries as there is wineries.
Well, yeah, so there's a few reasons for that. One is when you go to a brewery, breweries are very sterile environments. By their nature, they have to be. They're dealing with such a low percentage of alcohol in their product. It's very sensitive to any kind of bacterial infection or error in the process. Because of that, they have to be very sterile by their very nature. Wineries, a little bit more forgiveness, but not much. So they have also very sterile environments. And what they do is they overcome that sterility with their experience in the tasting rooms that they have. So the breweries, just by the nature of the people who own breweries versus people who own and operate wineries versus people who own and operate distilleries, if you line them up against a wall, they're all very different how they approach things. I freely admit that. I have a much more kind of engineering style focus on the distilling side, and a winemaker has much more of a winemaker's approach to something and how they think about product versus the beer makers. It's really interesting if you interviewed people and you didn't ask them what they did beforehand, but you asked them a series of questions and how they thought about things, you'd be able to tell if they operated a brewery or winery distillery.
Oh, that's true.
Very distinctly, different personalities. So we tried at Heritage Distilling to take the best of both worlds. We wanted to take the interesting varietal production you have as a local craft brewery, lots of different products and a taproom environment where people can enjoy themselves, with the visual intoxication that good, well-planned winery experiences bring together. Think about Napa Valley and some of the other Sonoma Valley, how they integrate the customer into the experience. We wanted to combine the two of those into our distillery experience, which I think we've done a pretty good job of that. But we're learning every day, and we're adapting, and we're thinking of new things. That is so important to engage the customer, and it's critical to allow that to happen. One of the challenges that we as an industry face across the U.S. is the laws in many of these states are still very tight in terms of what distillery owners can do. Not all states allow their distilleries to provide samples or mix some cocktails in their tasting rooms. Not all of the states allow the distilleries to sell bottles to customers in their tasting rooms. That's a real problem for the industry, because no brewery in America, no craft brewery in America would survive if a customer could not walk in, sample a beer, and order a pint and drink it. No winery in America would survive as a new start if customers couldn't walk in, sample it, order a glass, and buy a bottle. And yet many of these state laws are so restrictive that they're asking distilleries to try to be successful economically, but not giving them the tools to bring parity to wineries and breweries. And so it's very critical that listeners to your show, people who are out there in the space who want to support local craft spirits, know they really need to be talking to the local state senators and representatives and assemblymen to say, if we want to see this next level of production, manufacturing, job creation, and investment in the distilleries that we've seen flourish with wineries and breweries, they got to open it up and let them have some freedom to engage the customer, sell the product, make some cocktails, sell some bottles. It's pretty basic.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurial 101.
Yeah, it is. It's to your point, it's exactly walking into any winery brewery. It's being able to do that same thing. And, you know, and it does. It's a huge part of the economy. It's a huge part of media today, is those abilities to have those freedoms to, as a consumer, to go and meet the people who are making your product. And that's where, you know, walking into something like a distillery, you're going to be able to know everything about that product from walking in those doors and being able to talk to them and try that, instead of the very box store approach to, it's on sale on a shelf, so maybe I'll give it a shot. You know, that is, you know, a lot of, you know, you'll hear people throw out terms like targeted marketing and things like that, but there is nothing that's ever going to beat the opportunity to talk to the person that's part of the process about a product and be able to sample it.
That's right. We call it liquid to lips. So the thing with craft spirits is that they're often much more expensive than your mainstream mass-produced stuff you see at the liquor store or the bar. Yep. Simply because the craft producers they lack the scale to reach real economic efficiency on a pre-ended basis. So because they're making smaller batches and smaller quantities, they don't get the buying power for even basic things like glass and labels and that kind of stuff. They lack the economic equitability of the big brands. So what they can use, though, is the ability to bring people in the tasting rooms, go to festivals, go to retail, sample people in the products. Customers are not likely to go in and buy a $40 bottle of craft vodka or a $50 bottle of craft whiskey unless they can try it first.
Yep.
Customers are very frugal when it comes to that kind of thing. They trust what they know. They want to try something, and then they want to share it and gift it to friends. And what I'm talking about when I say, bringing some economic freedom to distilleries, the same that breweries and wineries enjoy, that doesn't mean blow the doors off and completely upend all the liquor laws in the states, because I believe we're tremendous partners with our distributors and with our retail partners. So my job is to get someone in our tasting room, sample them on a product, maybe they'll buy a bottle. And what I want them to do is, when they finish that bottle at home, I want them to go to the local liquor store or grocery store and buy it from that retail partner. I want them to do that because it supports the retail partner. Mm-hmm. And that bottle means if it was on the shelf at a retail store, I sold it to my distributor. My distributor had success getting it placed in the store, and the customer found it. And it's a much more efficient model for me to do, but you got to be able to get the people to try it first, the first time at least.
You really do, because that's a big thing. Alcohol, wine, spirits, beers, whatever you want to call it. One of the things that you'll notice is, as just like people's palates change, and we mentioned that earlier, the people's knowledge of all of this changes, because if you look at the chain restaurants, and it's all happy hour drinks and buy two, get one, whatever it is. It's all about quantity. And, when I go here, they're going to give me a 16-ounce cocktail versus where I go over here, they give me a goblet and it has just a couple ounces or whatever it is in there. There is the difference that most people don't understand is that 16-ounce cocktail is for the most part filler. It is, it's just a lot of junk in there. Whereas you go and you get that ounce or 2 ounces of a truly phenomenal product, it's like reteaching people how to drink, because taking those sips is so impactful. There's so much flavor. There's so many little subtleties of tasting, like with the BSB, the brown sugar, the cinnamon, and the bourbon. You're not going to get that kind of experience out of a 16-ounce cocktail that's part of some happy hour pricing somewhere, and people are concerned, I'm going to drink this in 2 swallows. You're really not.
Yeah, spirits are much different in terms of the consumption habits of the consumer versus beer or wine. We're seeing the industry change rapidly before our very eyes when it comes to beer and this thing called flavorable beverages, where they're basically, the breweries are taking very basic malt and they're making it like a beer with alcohol, running it through filters, stripping out all the flavor, stripping out all the color, making a 4 or 5% clear carbonated alcohol base, and then adding flavor to it and putting it in the can and calling it a spiked seltzer or a hard seltzer. It's really a 4% beer product. And because they can strip out the color, strip out the flavor, and package it in a certain way, the consumer thinks that it's better for them or lower calories. Alcohol is alcohol. Depending on the amount of alcohol you have per unit of volume, you're going to have a certain minimum number of calories. You cannot make a zero calorie alcohol, but that thing does not exist chemically in the universe. If it does exist, it's artificial, and you need to ask how is it being branded as a consumer-based alcohol.
Right.
So But to your point about flavor and sampling, you walked by our booth at the NRA show in Chicago.
Yep.
If you had not had this opportunity to sample BSB, Brown Sugar Bourbon, and to taste it and think about it, had you simply walked by it on a store shelf somewhere and seen it, chances are you would not have noticed it or picked it up and brought it home because you hadn't had a chance to try it as a product.
Yep.
So again, we think getting BSB in front of people, especially getting them in front of chefs. I tell our distributor sales teams all the time, every case of BSB that you might sell to a bar in the front of the house for the bar and for the cocktail menu, you can sell a case or two of BSB to the back of the house because the chefs appreciate what we've done, how we make the product, the flavor profile. And if you're one of the very successful restaurants, you're making barbecue sauces or bread puddings, BSB is fantastic in bread pudding. It makes an amazing riff on a Bananas Foster instead of using amaretto. And just imagine the natural odor of the BSB and the cinnamon caramelizing as you're flambéing it in front of the customer on a tableside service with ice cream and bananas. It just goes on glazes for hams and porks, pulled pork barbecue, chicken. BSB, I tell people, it's the perfect product. It's great straight. It's great on ice. It makes tremendous cocktails. You just substitute out any regular bourbon or whiskey, and the flavor profile changes the depth and complexity of the cocktail. It makes amazing old fashions. You don't have to put an orange cube in your old fashioned anymore because there's already brown sugar in the BSB.
Yep.
And the level of depth of complexity is there. You can make interesting cocktails like a Manhattan, where instead of using sweet vermouth, because we already have brown sugar in the BSB, you make a reverse Manhattan using some dry vermouth to counteract and balance out the sweetness a little bit. So it makes great cocktails. You can drink it straight, but the secret weapon is really how are you going to use it in cooking, in the kitchen, at the barbecue, and enjoy it in that kind of way.
And it really is, and it was amazing product to taste while I was there. Cooking was, you know, my brain a lot of times goes to cooking first and foremost whenever I taste just about anything. But, you know, seeing a product that I don't have to do a lot to. So as a chef, if I'm working on a dish or I'm working on a new menu and I'm going to say I want to do a bourbon menu or I want to do a spirits menu, to know that I can bank on the fact that this product I'm going to get special in for this dinner or for this menu, I don't have to do anything to it. I can trust it's going to have these notes. It's going to bring that flavor, and it's going to be a real flavor, not like, you know, very much like you said, the whipped cream vodka. It's not going to have that artificial aspartame chemical flavor, that impurities that I'm going to have to work around. I'm going to be able to develop a clean dish, trust that this is an ingredient, just like I go pick out my proteins. You know, you go to a local farm and get a protein. It is very, very different than going to a box store and picking up a protein. You know you're going to have to do things to it in order for it to carry that flavor profile. And where something like this is, it's there. It's ready to go, and I can count on it.
Well, the thing we're most proud of on BSB is we submitted it to the World Whiskey Awards in 2018. And that's an award competition that is put on by Whiskey Magazine, probably the preeminent magazine with experts in the field, writers, guests' opinions, makers, bartenders from around the world. So we submitted BSB. They have 8 categories, so best bourbon, best rye whiskey, best single malt, best scotch, and so on. One of the categories is flavored whiskey. Again, flavored whiskey is growing at almost 10% a year in just the U.S. alone in terms of volume and dollars sold. Well, we won Best Flavored Whiskey in the World from Whiskey Magazine, and they only give out one award. There are lots of different spirits, beer, and wine competitions where you submit your product, and they give out 100 gold medals and 5 double golds and 1,000 silver medals. At the World Whiskey Awards, they give out one medal per category, and BSB won. And it's all the biggest players on the planet you can think of that have different flavor profiles of whiskey that they submit. So that was tremendous. I mean, we were honored and thrilled. So we submitted again this year, and we won again.
Wow.
World's best flavor whiskey. 2 years in a row. Never happened before. It's never happened before back-to-back for our category. And now all of a sudden, we're getting lots of interest. People look at it and say, okay, that's a legitimate product. Those are legitimate awards. Double-blind tasting happened overseas in London. And we're thrilled by that. And so then next thing we did, okay, evolution of our company, we've got to grow. We were able to sign a national distribution deal for BSB. It's now in all 50 states. That's unheard of for a company of our size. Usually you have to go put together a hodgepodge of different distributors state by state by state. We were able to go in and negotiate with the biggest distributor in the country, a master agreement. So BSB now is available in all 50 states. Unheard of in the craft space.
That really is, because so many craft cocktails are struggling to go region by region or market by market and fight in tooth and nail to claw to get that penetration of the market, and to be able to go in and be successful and prove that you're putting out a superior quality, really well-made product to get that 50 state reach is incredible.
Well, one of the things I'm most proud of is as we built our team at the Heritage Distilling over the last 8 years, not a single one of us came from the beer, wine, or spirits industry. No formal training on marketing, sales, distribution. My background in chemical engineering lends itself to the production side, because that's really about production, how you make product equipment, how you use it, how you design it, that kind of thing. But anybody can make product. Can you plan? Can you make it affordable within a certain range of what your target demographic is? Can you market it? Can you sell it? Can you distribute it? So none of our team had that kind of alcohol, liquor, spirits experience. I think what we've done is we analyze everything a little bit backwards. We look at the alcohol space. You know, there are some things about it that are a little crazy. It's a system that was built after Prohibition ended. It's over 80 years old. It hasn't evolved as quickly as the rest of the economy and much of the rest of society in terms of what customers want and how they get access to products. I get that. But if I were to sit and construct a system from scratch, it would lead to certain results. So as we built the company, built our team, and executed, we just put up on a big whiteboard, how would a rational person think about the business? We built the business that way. And we go and have meetings and we show people what we're doing, how and why. Their head kind of blows up a little bit because no one's really thought about doing things the way we're doing them. Now, on the flip side, we've got this national distribution deal. We're learning from them now about, from the distributor, we're learning about certain things that we have to do. We're eager to do those things because now we're playing at a national level. We're in the major leagues now. And so some of those things we've got to do, but we were able to build the foundation of the company in such a way that we were able to deconstruct the industry, figure out how to reconstruct it for our own purposes, and then take product to market. And the results are where we are today.
And that's, you know, that's the thing that I think is so impactful is you're taking a different approach, which really and truly is the times. You know, so many things have been done. And done and done and done and done and done. There's even movies now. Movies are cycling through the same concept, just repackaged. They know they're not necessarily taking it back to the drawing board and going at a different approach. They're just repackaging it. You're taking something that people know in spirits, in the spirits world. They know them. They know the name bourbon. They know the name whiskey. And you've found your own way to bring that to the table while maintaining every standard and quality that anybody could possibly want in a spirit, and kind of still encompassing that entire, you know, like when I met your people there at NRA, still encompassing a very family-friendly family environment?
Well, it's a family-run business still. My wife's the president of the company. She's in the office every day. You know, if you were to meet some of our people, we've got multiple husband and wife teams, brother and sister teams, aunt and uncle teams who work for us in different capacities. We try to approach it from the perspective of how do we want to be treated, and we should treat people the same way. It's very much a meritocracy. We want to support people and what they want to do. If you come in and get a job and then you excel at that job and you want to learn more, we'll support you in that. If you come and work for us, we've got a number of people who have come to work for us while they're in college, or working on their master's programs, and they graduate and they go off and get tremendous job offers. We support them in that. We want to build a network of people who are good at what they do, who helped us to grow the business. We started an employee stock option plan. Every employee in the company is eligible to participate in the plan. We didn't just reserve stock for a few core executives. We've not set this company up so that one or two people own it on the backs of everybody else doing work. Everybody who works for us gets a chance to own some stock and grow with us. I'm a big believer in the sharing the wealth of what everybody helps to create. And that kind of environment lends itself to people wanting to do more. And what I try to do is run the company in such a way that people never want to leave. But that when they do leave, they leave on such a good note that they always want to be part of it. And so in that way, you've got to support people while they're working for you. And to run a company that is so amazing that people ultimately don't want to leave because they want to be part of it forever.
Well, it's always an interesting thing to hear that kind of way to build a business, because it's like you're building a company that you would want to work for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
life is short.
Yeah.
you can sleep when you're dead. the world is full of a-holes. You know, and there's no need to subject yourself to that. Abraham Lincoln helped end slavery, and there's nothing that ties you to any one person or company. We have total economic freedom in the U.S. to go find opportunities and to go pursue them, and that's the key: is to be motivated, find the opportunity, find what interests you, and then figure out how to go do it. For some of us, it takes 10 years, 20 years, 30 years to find it. Some people are lucky and they find it just out of college. Everybody's different. Everybody has a responsibility to take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of them, and then to find the right thing that will help them grow as people and that helps them become part of a bigger, better operation.
I couldn't agree more. Now, you know, we're talking with Justin Stiefel of Heritage Distilling Company, and you know, this is family meal, so we'd like to share stories from around different dinner tables, and those dinner tables can come in the workplace, they can come at home, it doesn't really matter. And you talked about how this all came up through a conversation around a campfire. Do you have any fun dinner table stories or great memories?
Great memories. So my wife and I, we went to Europe this summer, took our three kids, they age 15, 13 and 11. We spent about a week and a half in Italy and brought some chefs in and they showed the family how to make pasta. And, so we actually started now making our own pasta at home. Got one of those little pasta roller machines, and the kids still are excited and want to be part of that. Well, we do that at home. I love preparing Thanksgiving dinner. I have a couple stuffing and gravy recipes that are somewhat non-traditional takes on what people would normally think of as Thanksgiving meals. And other than that, you know, we like the barbecue. We have a Traeger. We're doing all sorts of interesting things on the Traeger. One of the cocktails we make with BSB is called Pineapple Upside Down Cake. Nice. It's really easy to make. It's equal parts of BSB, brown sugar bourbon, pineapple juice, and lemonade. So 2 ounces of BSB, 2 ounces of lemonade, 2 ounces of pineapple juice, and a maraschino cherry. And it tastes just like a pineapple upside down cake.
Oh, yeah.
So my wife, very easy to make, refreshing, fresh. We submitted as a contestant cocktail in a national contest for a hotel chain that wanted to make a craft cocktail that they would feature across the country, and it won. So now that upside down pineapple cake drink is being featured at the state pineapple chain of hotels all across the country.
That's pretty cool.
So my wife made a riff on that. She makes actual pineapple upside down cake with the pineapple rings in individual muffin tins, and we put a little bit of BSB in there, and then put a cherry on top, and put that on the Traeger and let it bake on the Traeger. And a little bit of smokiness, the BSB comes through, the cake is nice and moist, the pineapple ring is crispy, and the cherry is right there in the center. And because the BSB is added, you get subtle hints of bourbon with the brown sugar and the cinnamon notes, of course. And it's just a way to take that cooking outdoors, but still, again, use BSB in a recipe that traditionally people might not have thought about.
I think that's good. It's an amazing way to do it. And that's what makes, getting people back together around food and great drinks and beverages so important, is because one, you never know what you're going to create that is going to become this lifelong story and this lifelong thing that you have at every one of these, get-togethers. But it's so fun and so much of an interesting expression to, just make new foods, make new drinks that you all can enjoy together and build those memories off of. Now, Justin, where can anybody listening find more about Heritage?
Well, we ask you to go to our webpage, heritagedistilling.com. Not Heritage Distillery, but heritagedistilling.com. You can find us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, BSB, brown sugar bourbon, and BSB 103, which is the 103 proof version of BSB.
Whew.
It's the only overproofed flavored whiskey in the world. Nobody else has ever made an overproof flavored whiskey. Most flavored whiskeys are like 70 proof, roughly.
Yeah.
At 103 proof, it's fantastic. It's got a little less sweetness, a more traditional whiskey burn, but still incredibly smooth. And people who are whiskey aficionados really gravitate towards it because it's such a unique product. Both of those products, BSB and BSB 103, are available nationwide. If you don't see it at your local liquor store, ask them to special order it. They can get it from Southern Wine and Spirits or any number of a handful of other distributors or their state liquor systems. Ask for it at bars and restaurants. That's the best way, is when people ask for something and that momentum builds, then the bartender, the food and beverage director, the executive chef, they feature the product. We greatly appreciate it as a family-run business. We also have a Instagram handle for BSB. It's brown sugar bourbon, and we like to use the hashtag drinking BSB.
And you guys are going to be a big part of a pretty major event coming to Dallas in not too long now.
The World Food Championships. We were approached by them, WFC, honored to be partners with them now. So we're exclusive bourbon of the entire World Food Championship. Product is going to be featured there. We're just excited to, help spread the nuance again of allowing individual folks who want to break into that world, whether it's personal or professional desires they have. We're thrilled to support them in that.
Well, I am looking forward to seeing you there. I'll be there with the sports desk, and we're going to have a good time. And, again, we're talking with Justin Stiefel of Heritage Distilling Company. It has been an honor and a pleasure to have you on. I am looking forward to cooking with and drinking more of your product and just really enjoying the story behind it. And so if you haven't had a chance to look them up, again, check them out on the website, on social media, and get yourself to one of their distilleries. And you're listening to Family Meal with Chef Mark Conway. And, I really thank you again, Justin, for being on. And I thank you for listening. Send me your comments and questions. I can't wait to hear what you think. And we'll see you next time.